Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Two generals are fighting for power, and a country that once had hope for democracy is now suffering one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. According to the United Nations, 14 million people have been displaced within a single country. A third of the population is starving. 26 million people don't have enough to eat. And yet, almost no one is talking about this catastrophe. Who stands to gain from the war in Sudan? Politically, economically, maybe even internationally? And who is helping those who've lost everything? In Crisis Mode, the podcast from the world's crises and war zones with journalist Jan Jessen.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from conflict zones with Jan Jessen.
Hi, I'm Jan Jessen, head of politics at NRZ and war and crisis reporter for the Funk Media Group. Hundreds of thousands of people in Sudan are facing starvation. Cities in Darfur are under siege, clinics and markets are being bombed, and at the same time, the crisis has almost completely vanished from international attention. The war in Sudan, it's a forgotten war. I haven't been there myself. Not yet, unfortunately. For journalists, entering the country is extremely difficult, almost impossible. But I've spoken with people who are on the ground or have been there until recently. Roman Deckert is a journalist and Sudan expert who helps us understand the political situation. Jerome Stoll from Welthungerhilfe coordinates aid projects from Port Sudan. And Maria Fix from Doctors Without Borders spent a total of a year there. She talks about the suffering of civilians and the courage of those who keep helping. To understand what's happening in Sudan right now, we first need to know who's fighting whom. I spoke with Roman Deckert, journalist and Sudan expert. So, to begin, let's take a look at the map. Who controls which parts of the country?
Ja, gerade muss man also feststellen, dass das Land faktisch gespalten ist. Es gibt also eine östliche.
Right now, it must be acknowledged that the country is essentially divided. The eastern half is controlled by the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, under General Abdel Fattah Burhan. While the western half, basically everything west of the capital Khartoum, especially the Darfur region, is held by the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF. On the battlefield, the army currently has a slight upper hand. There are fights over the city of El Obeid in the west, but most notably over El Fashir, the largest city in Darfur, described by observers as truly hell on earth. Hundreds of thousands are threatened by starvation, and an absolutely horrific battle is raging over the city. The RSF militias have been growing stronger since the 2000s. They originally stem from the fleeing Janjaweed militias. The RSF leader, known as Metier, earned massive petrodollars from mercenary activities and also built extensive business networks, especially in the United Arab Emirates.
Es tobt also eine wirklich fürchterliche Schlacht um diese Stadt.
The state army that Roman Deckert mentioned is controlled by a general named Abdel Fattah Burhan. He's essentially the head of state in Sudan right now, not officially by title, but in practice, because he's the army chief and the most powerful man in the country. On the other side are the rapid support forces, also mentioned by Deckert. They're led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also a general. He used to be Burhan's deputy. The rapid support forces were originally militias that fought on the government side in Darfur. You might remember, a few years ago, there was already a brutal war in the western provinces of Darfur, with countless deaths, mass displacement, and horrific atrocities. Those very militias, which later became the rapid support forces, were among the main instigators of that conflict. So naturally the question is, where did these militias come from and what drives them?
In other words, this is a war business. The RSF is a vast business empire. The government army under Burhan is, in fact, at odds with the Emirates. But the gold mine in eastern Sudan still flows almost entirely to Dubai. It's very complex. The lines are blurred. But one thing is clear. This is a war economy, a big business. And the ones paying the price are the ordinary people, the civilian population.
These entanglements don't just make the conflict complex, they also make it profitable. Gold fuels mercenary networks and wealthy backers abroad. The war in Sudan has long since become a business. But we'll get to that later. So what's the situation on the ground? For 2 years now, this civil war has been raging in Sudan. As Deckert explained, the country is practically split in two. In the east, the state army, SAF, holds control. In the west, it's the rapid support forces. And of course, as in so many wars, the generals are the ones benefiting, while the people are the ones starving. I spoke with Jeroen Stoll from Welthungerhilfe. He coordinates the organization's programs from Port Sudan, covering everything from the relatively stable east to the war-torn regions in the west.
There's, of course, less opportunity for the communities to grow their crops, but also less opportunity to access humanitarian aid. So these are the areas where the humanitarian situation is most dire. Of course, we talk about the Darfur areas, the Kordofan areas, and other areas where access is limited.
Access is dangerous, supply chains are collapsing, and people are starving. And dangerous access also means danger for those trying to help. The local aid workers from Welthungerhilfe and others from the few organizations still operating in the country. The World Food Programme warns that a third of the population depends on aid, and the available resources are nowhere near enough. I asked Jeroen whether Sudan still gets enough attention compared to other crises, and, to put it casually, where Sudan would rank on a kind of global disaster index.
Please allow me not to give a direct answer to this question, but I think that it is with Gaza right up there. But it's not a competition, if you know what I mean. But this is not to dismiss your question. It is massive. The challenges ahead are massive. The challenges for the local communities, the local populations are massive. Yeah, and Ukraine may be right up there. Gaza, Sudan, absolutely. And it seems so incredibly protracted.
This is the core problem with Sudan, or Africa in general, one has to say. Africa is a continent forgotten by the world, or at least by the Western world. Some of you might also remember the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. It's been simmering for a while, and at one point there were up to 500,000 deaths, and hardly anyone cared. Other conflict zones around the world are similar. Take Yemen, for example, where a war is raging that relatively few people pay attention to. Our focus, at least in the West, is clearly on Gaza and Ukraine. And of course, that makes things extremely difficult for aid organizations operating in countries with major crises like Sudan. These organizations rely on funding, and if certain conflicts aren't in the public or media spotlight, the donations simply don't flow. That's a huge problem, not just for the aid organizations, but above all, for the people affected. In besieged cities like Al-Fashir in the Darfur region, or in camps also in Darfur, people are cut off from the rest of the world. Al-Fashir is a city of around 300,000 people, and it has been under siege for months. The reports coming out of Al-Fashir are truly horrifying. People are forced to survive on grass, or who knows what else. Nothing edible is getting in. It's a mega catastrophe. Yet, as I said, it barely gets coverage. Aid shipments get stuck, warehouses are empty, and many international teams had to pull out. Yet Sudanese staff remain, despite the life-threatening conditions.
I would say it is dangerous. People are exposed to active violence on a day-to-day basis, potentially. Access, mobility, it has significantly reduced. As trying to be an accommodating and responsible employer, we give people the choice, the opportunity to leave. And many say no, we choose to stay because this is our home. This is where our families hail from and our families are. And I mean that's quite a human story, I must say.
As is often the case in conflicts, it's not just that the fighting targets military infrastructure. There are also attacks on medical facilities. And that's something Maria Fix experienced firsthand. She's a nurse and spent a total of 1 year in Sudan with Doctors Without Borders, working under extremely harsh conditions.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me. I'm always grateful for the chance to talk about Sudan, because honestly, I feel the level of attention the country gets is far too low, especially considering that the war has been going on for more than 2 years now. I spent almost an entire year of that time in Sudan, and from what I've seen, nothing is improving. In fact, it feels like people are talking about it less and less, even though the humanitarian situation keeps getting worse. Medical facilities are being destroyed. There are countless civilian casualties. Markets and hospitals are bombed. And even refugee camps are being wiped out. Sadly, there's been no sign of improvement at all. On the contrary, over the past 2 years, things have only gotten worse, while the world's attention has steadily faded away.
Maria was in cities like Niala, which used to be the country's second largest city. Today, it's largely destroyed.
Mein erster Einsatz im Sudan habe ich tatsächlich in Darfur gehabt, in Süddarfur.
My first deployment in Sudan was actually in Darfur. At that time, we had only been back in the country for a few months, even though we had worked there before the war. I was in Yala itself, which was completely destroyed. There was hardly any life left in the city itself. Many people, of course, who had managed to stay there because they couldn't afford to leave, had gathered around the outskirts of the city. During the few months I was there, things had somewhat stabilized, but attacks were still happening, including airstrikes on the city, which caused many injuries and deaths. And those airstrikes are still going on even today.
In some regions, there is practically no healthcare system left. And of course, it's generally difficult, even if the health system were still somewhat functioning. But there are tens of millions of internally displaced people in this country, fleeing from one place to another. And naturally, providing for such a massive number of refugees is extremely challenging. You might remember the problems Germany faced back in 2014 to 2015, when around 1 million people arrived. Whether it was the healthcare system, the education system, or whatever, there were huge debates and massive logistical challenges. How do we manage this? Now imagine a country like Sudan, where 14 million people are on the run amid an active war, with bombings, shootings, and destroyed health facilities. That's a catastrophe on a whole other level. And that's why cholera is spreading, mothers are dying in childbirth, and children are starving.
Gerade da, wo ich gearbeitet habe in Yala, wir hatten enorm viele schwangere Frauen, die während der Schwangerschaft.
Right where I was working in Niala, we had an enormous number of pregnant women who died either during pregnancy or shortly after giving birth. This was mainly because they had to travel long distances to reach a hospital, and because so few health facilities were still functioning. You see similar issues with children who often can't get into facilities to be treated for things like malnutrition or don't have enough access to care for diarrheal diseases, which they're particularly vulnerable to, or malaria. And for me personally, sexual violence is always a huge issue. It's rampant. In Sudan, sexual violence is even used as a weapon of war. I think just in June of this year, in Tawila, there were 113 consultations for sexual violence in a single week. And it's not only women who are affected, it's children too. The youngest case we recorded was a 5-year-old. That hits me very hard personally. Even when I was in Niala before, in that short time, we saw so many cases. And I think we were only seeing the tip of the iceberg, because many people either have no access, don't know where to go for help, or there's simply no support available, like psychological care.
Und wir haben, glaube ich, nur das, also den Tipp des Eisbergs gesehen, weil viele natürlich weder den Zugang haben, noch wissen, wo sie Versorgung bekommen, noch dazu fehlt es dann an so Sachen wie psychologische Unterstützung.
Still, and this is truly remarkable and absolutely worthy of appreciation, aid workers remain on the ground, not just the local teams, but in some cases, international staff as well, staying in the country and doing their best to provide help, making assistance actually possible, and that is truly extraordinary.
Also im Großen und Ganzen würde ich sagen, Gott sei Dank ist uns als Ärzte an der Grenzen bisher relativ wenig, aber einfach ist es nicht. Also wir müssen enorm viele Maßnahmen auch einhergehen, dass wir sicher gehen.
Overall, I'd say, thankfully, so far very little has happened to us as doctors without borders staff. But it's definitely not easy. We have to follow a huge number of measures to make sure everything stays safe. There are so many checkpoints we have to go through. It's not just attacks on health facilities either. Aid workers themselves are also affected, injured, or even killed. We've also provided support at the hospital in Salingi in central Darfur. In fact, just this year in August, several people were injured and even killed in the emergency department. department there. It's not easy, but we operate very much according to the principle of neutrality. That means we talk to all parties in the conflict, but it also means we communicate where we are and continually insist that international law is respected, even in these situations.
Das heißt, wir unterhalten uns mit allen Kriegsparteien. Das heißt aber auch, dass wir kommunizieren, wo wir sind und auch natürlich sehr stark immer wieder darauf beharren, dass das Völkerrecht auch in solchen Situationen wahrgenommen wird.
And now we need to return to the question of funding. The financing of aid work on the ground, for medical support, for food assistance, for all the help being provided. And the question, especially in Sudan, is this. As we've already discussed, attention is low, so is enough money actually reaching the aid organizations to provide the support that's needed? Clearly the answer is no, and Maria has confirmed this as well.
Also ich glaube, die Antwort ist ganz klar, da ist auf jeden Fall noch Luft nach oben. Das Problem ist einfach, dass allgemein dadurch, dass eben wenig Aufmerksamkeit aus politischer Sicht quasi von vielen Ländern weltweit.
I think the answer is quite clear. There's definitely still room for improvement. The problem is that, in general, very little political attention from many countries around the world is focused on Sudan, which makes the allocation of aid funds extremely difficult. As Médecins Sans Frontières, we're financially independent, meaning we're not reliant on receiving government funding. That's actually helped us a bit this year, because earlier in the year, a lot of funds from the U.S. were pulled, and we saw that some other organizations really struggled as a result. Even so, we can't nearly cover everything that's needed there. I would hope that not only political attention, bureaucracy and all, improves, but also that the distribution of aid funds gets better, so that Sudan can benefit more from it.
Nicht nur die politische Aufmerksamkeit, also was auch Bürokratie da angeht, aber auch dass quasi die Verteilung von Hilfsgeldern vielleicht auch wieder besser werden könnte und dass der Sudan auch davon mehr abbekommt.
While the people of Sudan are fighting for every kilo of flour, the top of the state is fighting over power, gold and a system that makes war profitable. Sudan sits strategically between the Sahel region and the Red Sea. It's a country with gold, oil and vast agricultural land. However, much of the farmland is no longer as usable as it once was, back when Sudan was a major exporter of agricultural products. Much of the land has been destroyed by climate change. This is similar to Afghanistan, another country I often travel to and report on. We can even include one or two reports from Afghanistan in the show notes. Sudan, like Afghanistan, is heavily affected by climate change. Both are countries that contributed little to the problem but suffer the most from its consequences. This, as I said, makes the situation in Sudan even worse. On top of the ongoing conflicts, which the country has endured for many years, now compounded by 2 years of a massive civil war and the additional impacts of climate change. But because Sudan is so resource-rich, it's also highly contested and attracts interest from neighboring states and international actors trying to extract profits. For decades, power in Sudan was maintained by weapons, not elections. After the fall of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir, who ruled for 30 years, there was a brief hope for democracy and peace in 2019. Civil society rose up, attempting to guide Sudan toward a peaceful, democratic future. It was remarkable, but that hope was buried by the two generals now fighting each other. Roman Deckert knows the power circles, the militias and the history, and he says, "This war is no accident."
Das heißt, es ist ein Kriegsbusiness.
In other words, this is a war business. The RSF is a vast business empire. The government army under Burhan is, in fact, at odds with the Emirates. But the gold mine in eastern Sudan still flows almost entirely to Dubai. It's very complex. The lines are blurred. But one thing is clear. This is a war economy, a big business. And the ones paying the price are the ordinary people, the civilian population.
Und die Zeche zahlen im Prinzip die einfachen Leute, die Zivilbevölkerung.
And then we also need to broaden our view to the international level. The war in Sudan, like so many conflicts worldwide, is influenced by international actors. For example, the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, are supported by Egypt and Saudi Arabia, while the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, receive backing from the United Arab Emirates. Money flows in from abroad and gold flows back out. There are also countries like Germany, which has its own historical ties. For many years, back when the GDR existed, Sudan was used as a stage for the rivalry between East and West. At that time, Sudan received massive weapon support from the Federal Republic of Germany. Other interest groups play a role too, for instance, Ukraine, which supports the SAF. On the other side, Russia, through the Wagner mercenaries, has at least partially supported the RSF, although that seems to have decreased somewhat. As Roman Deckert points out, this is not purely a Sudanese struggle for power. It's a regional and international power play.
Und diese Koalition unterstützt die Regierungsarmee unter General Burhan. Oder auf der anderen Seite ist ganz klar, also ich kenne niemand Ernsthaftes, der das wirklich in Abrede stellt, sind die Vereinigten Arabischen Emirate.
And this coalition supports the government army under General Burhan. On the other side, it's clear, I don't know anyone serious who would dispute this. The United Arab Emirates actively back the RSF militias, providing supplies, financial support, and logistical aid. I also never get tired of pointing out that the West is involved as well. I think it's crucial to highlight this, so people don't get the impression that, oh, somewhere deep in Africa, people are just fighting each other. No, this is also a modern war, driven hard and fast by geopolitical interests. And Western countries are involved too, primarily by simply not prioritizing Sudan.
Der, wo es ganz knallhart um realpolitische Interessen geht, geopolitische Interessen, und die westlichen Länder hängen da auch mit drin, vor allen Dingen, indem sie eigentlich den Sudan nicht wirklich priorisieren.
And above all, Sudan is simply not being prioritized. That's something we need to keep in mind when talking about Sudan. As I said, this is not a regional or local conflict. It's a conflict fueled from the outside. But of course, the core of the struggle remains Sudanese. There are always people who claim it's a conflict between Arabs on one side, the RSF militias being seen as Arab tribal fighters, and Africans on the other, supposedly oppressed by these Arabs. That would make it seem like an ethnic war. But Roman Deckert is very clear, that's definitely not the case. This is a struggle for power, not an ethnic war.
Ich bin da immer ein ganz großer Kritiker von dem Begriff, denn ethnischer Konflikt, das suggeriert ja, als wäre jetzt Ethnizität die Ursache von einem Konflikt. Und
I've always been a strong critic of the term ethnic conflict, because it implies that ethnicity is the root cause of the conflict. And if you look closer, that's obviously nonsense. It's far more complex, and the lines are blurred. You have to ask yourself, ethnicity, ethnic groups, what does that really mean? These are social groups, yes, often with different languages, but very quickly you slip into tribal or nationalist thinking. Of course, ethnic groups exist as social units, but often they are also social constructs. For me, the danger is that this framing slides into a somewhat racist logic. Suddenly, you're in a Karl May-style narrative. Tribes, enemies of each other, and it all becomes very folkloristic. And that obscures the fact that all of this is happening within a global context.
Folkloristisch. Also, und es verstellt eben den Blick darauf, dass das alles in einem globalen Kontext stattfindet, ja?
And despite all this dire situation, despite the horrific humanitarian crisis currently devastating Sudan, there is hope. And that hope comes from the grassroots, from civil society. I mentioned earlier that in 2019, when longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir was overthrown, later held accountable for war crimes in The Hague, there was a civil society uprising and an attempt to democratize Sudan. The remnants of those networks, those civil society groups, still exist today. Local networks like the Emergency Response Rooms keep the country running. They distribute food, organize medical aid, rebuild schools, essentially doing what a government should be doing. But the state or its structures are entangled in the war and show little concern for the needs of the civilian population. That's where civil society steps in. And that's something that gives hope for Sudan's future. These local networks were recently awarded an alternative Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of their work in places where international organizations can no longer reach. Roman Deckert has been observing these groups for some time.
Es gibt diese sehr stolze, starke Tradition der sudanesischen Zivilgesellschaft aus diesen Nachbarschaftskomitees, Neighborhood Resistance Committees hießen die damals.
There's this very proud and resilient tradition within Sudan's civil society, rooted in what used to be called the Neighborhood Resistance Committees. These groups have now evolved into the so-called Emergency Response Rooms, and they're essentially doing what should be the core responsibility of the state, making sure people have the basics they need to survive, food, medicine, and care. The state itself isn't providing that support. Instead, it's those strong men, who are fueling chaos, while over 600 emergency response rooms are keeping communities alive. They were even nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize last year, and they would have more than deserved it. That's where real hope lies. Of course, we have to be careful not to place all expectations on these grassroots activists or burden them with carrying an entire country on their shoulders. But still, they represent a remarkable source of hope.
Grassroots Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten, dass man ihnen das aufbürdet, aber da gibt's wirklich, wirklich Hoffnung.
When Roman Deckert talks about grassroots activists, he means grassroots movements. As the name suggests, movements that arise from within society itself, not imposed from above by the state. These are self-organized groups, similar to what we saw in Syria when the civil war began, before it became ideologically or religiously charged or fueled from the outside. In Syria, there were local coordination groups trying to organize protests against Assad and push the country toward a democratic path. I find it remarkable that such movements exist in war-affected countries, in difficult contexts, in nations that have suffered under dictatorships, that these grassroots movements can still emerge and organize, often underground. In the end, these groups are the hope that one day there might be peace in such countries. And the big question is whether Sudan will have a future beyond violence and external interference. Roman Deckert believes it can, cautiously, of course. For him, it's clear. Sudan can only survive if the military and militias step back and civil society is truly allowed to take charge.
Yeah, ich würde mir selber eher wünschen, dass es ein Sudan gibt, einen vereinten Sudan, in dem die Armee in die Baracken zurückkehrt.
Personally, what I'd really hope for is a united Sudan. One where the army returns to its barracks, the militias are disarmed, and the civil society finally gets a real chance to rebuild the country from the ground up. Because the truth is, Sudan is actually a rich country. It has everything it would need to thrive. But it's the military elites and the foreign powers in the region who are blocking that progress, who have no real interest in seeing a democratic Sudan emerge. And honestly, I think it's about time the West told those regional powers, let the Sudanese people take charge of their own future. Stay out of it. That, for me, is the core critique of Western foreign policy, and not just Germany's, but more broadly, that the interests of Gulf monarchies and Egypt are still being prioritized over the hopes and rights of the Sudanese people.
Und das ist meine Hauptkritik an westlicher Außenpolitik, nicht nur an deutscher Außenpolitik, aber auch, dass da dann die Interessen gegenüber den Golfmonarchien und Ägypten doch höher gestellt werden als das gegenüber dem Sudan.
Yes, and I think it's incredibly important to look at Sudan, a country where you see two realities. On top are those who profit from the war. There is apparently quite a bit of wealth in Sudan. On the bottom are those who have to survive this war. And in between, there are those trying to bring structure to their country and move it forward. Of course, there are also the aid workers, the local helpers, people risking their lives to assist their fellow citizens, and the international staff who come in to provide support. People like Jerome Stoll, Maria Fix, and countless Sudanese who stay despite all the odds, working to help. I definitely want to go there myself one day. I'm trying to find a way to get into Sudan. I truly believe we can only understand this conflict by seeing the people, not the generals, not the gold mines, but the children, the mothers, the doctors, the neighbors. And maybe that's really all we can do here. Look, help, and speak out so that this war doesn't remain in the shadows. That's the worst thing that can happen in humanitarian disasters, that they occur outside media and public attention, because then aid simply doesn't reach the country. And I believe that's exactly what's needed in Sudan and in other countries, that help is provided and people are supported. This episode was produced by Alexander Baumeister, also a journalist at the Funke Media Group radio station. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, follow, and recommend us. That helps make our work more visible. Take care, see you soon, and goodbye.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.